Hello, everyone. Thank you to our dear listeners who make this podcast possible. We would like to start this episode off with a warning that this film deals with triggering content such as sexual assault and domestic violence that we will be discussing in this episode. Take care.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Eiga Night, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the wide and wonderful world of Japanese cinema. I'm your co-host, Chris Luciantonio.
And I'm your co-host, Aruba.
And Aruba, can you believe that we are putting two episodes out in the same month?
Are we okay? Are we actually okay?
I think that 1 month in, we finally hit our 2020 New Year's goal of actually being productive for once.
Is it really productive when, the Patreon gizmos aren't coming in yet?
Well, just because we're not getting paid doesn't mean that we aren't motivated. Although, maybe somewhere down the line we can figure that out. But for the time being, we are just enjoying being a podcast, which, from what I can tell from other podcasts, it's a rare thing that happens.
Is this the part where I take my top off?
No, that'll never actually happen. Like, I don't know why it's a running joke for you. Why your exhibitionism is coming out on the podcast.
I mean, I did it when Leo won Best Actor. I really didn't, but...
You did it when who won Best Actor?
Leo!
Oh, who cares? That guy sucks.
It was a monumentous moment because how many nominations? But either way...
I suppose so, but yeah, we're just rolling on, so let's get into the new episode. Saito Ichigo's life is in shambles. As a 32-year-old burnout who has never had a real job, any responsibility to speak of, or reason to practice basic personal hygiene and grooming, her existence is stalled, leeching off her elderly parents and fighting with her sister. Forced out of the house and independent for the first time ever, she gets a part-time job at a convenience store, begins a curious relationship with a self-destructive amateur boxer, and picks up boxing herself, hoping to once and for all throw a punch back at the life that just keeps beating her down. This is the story of 100 Yen Love, as directed by Take Masaharu. And Aruba, let me just start with this one question. Would you let Ando Sakura punch you in the face? Because I would.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, no question about it. Ando Sakura is an absolute queen and was one of the biggest redeeming qualities of this movie for me.
This was a star... not making role, because she has been a famous actress for like a decade at this point of her career, but this was just like a film that really just highlights the nuances and skills that she puts into every performance. And by the end of the film, I don't know what was up with me. This is possibly like a awakening of some type. Like, man, I would just let her punch me in the face.
I mean, going back to Shoplifters, we were quite impressed with her little moments there. And this film basically, what's the word I'm looking for? Basically allows her more explosive moments to shine quite a bit.
Yeah, like they show a complete range of her acting ability. In Shoplifters, she is this completely motherly character, one of the most warming and just loving matriarchs that I think has ever been put to Japanese cinema. And in this one, she is one of the most kind of disgusting burnout characters I think ever released.
She's a slop ball.
Yes, absolutely. She is, one of my notes when I was writing this, I sent it to you. It's like, I can actually smell her by the way that the makeup work and and just her personal performance puts into it. Like, she looks rank in this film. And that's not an insult. She's supposed to. But, man, does it play off so well.
I literally have a list of every way they tried to make Ando Sakura look as disgusting as possible. Like, can I actually go into them right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like, when I was watching the film, I had this, like, being John Malkovich kind of reaction. Because, famously, that film starred Cameron Diaz, one of the most attractive actresses and biggest stars of the time. And they did everything they could to make her seem plain. As in, like, they didn't put her in makeup, they had to, like, gave her, like, this frizzy wig and everything. But at the end of the day, like, you're still looking at Cameron Diaz, so it doesn't really work. Like, you still you still see an incredibly beautiful woman, and in this case, too, like, you're still staring at Sakura Ando for the entire film, but wow, she is in rough shape in this, and it's great.
Yeah, she undergoes, a little... No, I wouldn't even say a little. She goes under quite a bit of a glow-up towards the end, but before she does that, I kind of outlined here, there's a shot of her and her nephew in the very, very beginning where she's kicking his ass at PlayStation 2, and even though there's a back on the couch, there's a camera shot specifically at their backs where you see Ando reach over and scratch her own back fat for a little bit. So instantly you're a little bit turned off because you see the ill-fitting clothing and her just basically behaving in her own home as she should. Then later on, after getting into a full-on fist fight with her older sister, Fumiko, she leaves covered in ketchup with one shoe on in her very slop and very comfortable, might I add, looking fashion. It's very brightly colored, and it's a choice. It's an aesthetic choice. It's not a fit I would choose for the really, really pretty tiny Ando. But so she leaves, and she leaves the house dirty as hell. Let's see what I got here. Her choice of underwear being the 100 yen underwear that she manages to rack up from her shop.
Okay, that comes later, because I have a whole thing on that, because just as you've been saying, the film tries as hard as it can to make you think that this woman is disgusting. Like, her face is greasy, her hair is unwashed and unkempt. She is chain smoking, she is eating like absolute shit. She dresses terribly. Like, you mentioned her, like, fluorescent, like, pink top and pajama bottoms. Like, that's not, like, by choice. She's probably been, like, sleeping in that for several days because it's the most clean thing she probably has. And at this point, like, we haven't mentioned it yet, she's a 32-year-old woman living with her parents and has never left home before this. So her elderly parents have been shouldering her as a responsibility for decades now, and she's God, just like you can't look at her and not feel some level of pathos for just how it seems harsh to use the word pathetic, but I don't know how else you phrase it. Like, she's living a pathetic life.
I mean, to her defense, it is pretty much a lot of her parents' fault. You know, her mother even gives her some money as she decides to leave, like, making sure that she's taken care of. You know, like, her mother really is another character, I should say. She's someone who we see very briefly for the film, but we get a lot of sense about the way her character has raised her children.
Yeah, a very, like, loving kind of spoiler of her kids. Like, you would not allow your daughter to be at this level of both unwashed, poor hygiene, and completely professionally, like, her professional life does not exist. She has no social life because she has no social skills. Like, the phrase that kept coming to my mind watching her was, NEET, not an education, employment, or training. Yeah. But that doesn't, like, really qualify her because she's so far off that spectrum. Like, she should have had something going for her before that. It's just there, nothing happened for her. Like, nothing started.
Yeah, she basically just remained that.
We're led to believe that she has been in that disgusting room, like, that we see in the opening with her kicking her nephew's ass at PlayStation 2. Like, we're led to believe that she's been in there for 32 years.
The thing is, though, she doesn't emit hikikomori qualities, though. She does have... She has no problem going outside and getting what she needs, and while her social skills are really off, you know, she doesn't have many qualms about actually needing to socialize.
No, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a strange kind of character for, well, both Ando to play and to feature as your protagonist, because she, for, like, the first, I would say, hour of this film, like, her entire performance is summed up with this deadened expression that crosses Ando's face and her, like, self-conscious mumbling. Like, that's her whole acting style for the first hour, and it, like, really, lends credence to her, like, transformation by the end of the film after she gets some semblance of control over her life. But so much of this film is just her lazily drifting through life and going with the punches and seeing so many transformations of, like, her life happen one after the other at rapid succession. Like, so, all of a sudden, like, she has an apartment of her own. She has a job. She has a...
Out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That and apartment came out of nowhere. I'm like, wait, honey, what?
I want to know how that works, because I would love to know where she got the... like, how she found a place so quickly. But regardless, like, it all happened so fast for her. Like, the apartment, the job, the, quote, boyfriend, unquote. We'll talk about that later. But everything for her changes so fast, and so much of her, like, so much of her arc, such as it is just going with it.
Yeah, that's essentially what Take hasn't managed to show us, like, cutting out the, I guess, the technicalities and cutting out the, you know, mundane of everyday life. He still manages to condense the interesting mundane, the slice of life that we're all very interested to see, you know, those milestones, and every single shot and storyline becomes very, very significant, even though there's, like, how many? I don't know. They're, like, literally every... It moves so fast that you're kind of losing track of the characters she meets and what significance they have within her life until the last of the other characters appear. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. It's like, as you said, it's a very slice of life type film where it's really drawing on the mundanity of this life, because her existence, so such as it is, isn't that interesting. It's actually quite common. Like, as, like, a 30-year-old burnout who's never done anything with her life, it's like, why would we try and affix this kind of, like, triumphant narrative to her? And there is kind of that aspect to it, and we kind of disagree on that, but we'll get into it when we talk about, like, where the film goes and what it does with her character. But yeah, let's just start breaking down some things. I really want to talk about this convenience store.
Yes, this Hyakuen shop that she manages to get a job at with, I gotta say, a quite addictive theme song it has, because every time you open up in this store, the song starts at the very, very beginning, and the chant goes, Hyakuen, Hyakuen, like, and then at a point, Suteki, Suteki, and it's a song that really, like, it's so, the contrast between the characters' voices and, like, Ando's monotone and the dialogue of the characters communicating in the store with that blaring in the background, it's so delightful to watch.
Yeah, it's very comedic, and, like, I think it just really underlines just how awful convenience store, like, employment is. To have to hear that chant, that over and over again on a loop every time, like, a new customer comes in, like, I don't understand how she can stand it, but, like, who knows what who knows what Ichiko is thinking from scene to scene. Like, she's a very closed book, and that's kind of, like, the appeal yeah. and allure of her character. But I just love, like, 100 Yen Love is, like, the store name, and that's where the title of the film comes from. And it's like, a perfect fit for her, because it kind of taps into this whole Japanese phenomenon of, like, convenience stores being a one-stop shopping thing for, like, store for everything. Like, you can yeah. literally live out a convenience store for years. And it seems like, from the way that they dress her room in her parents' house, is like, that's what she's been doing.
Yeah. I think it's important to note that this is a 100 yen convenience store, so the products themselves are immensely lower quality than regular convenience stores in Japan. However, that fits, because mm-hmm. you know who else is low quality? Freaking Ichiko.
Yeah, like, it's like the perfect job for her, because it does teach her responsibility, and it's actually the first time, like, that she's ever worked for something and had to be responsible for something beyond herself, which she isn't even responsible for, because her teeth are rotting out and she doesn't take care of herself. But it's perfect, because, like, the Western equivalent would be, like, a dollar store, and like, even like below that, like a value dollar store. And if you
a
know
a 24-hour dollar store.
Yes. And if you know the people who shop at those places exclusively, you know that they are not, like, a hero of a film. They are living tragic lives and need help, and that's what Ichiko really needs.
Or they are working holiday students, or starving students, or students in general.
That's what I said. They're tragic yeah. and they need help.
But there was actually one line in the interview process for this job when she applies.
I love that scene.
It's a nice scene, and I think this kind of maybe starts off where maybe it's like the catalyst for my critique of the entirety of the film. But she's interviewing for a night shift position, and hours are normally, I think it was like 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. But quote, and I quote, "Since she's a girl, she could work 10 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she's getting paid 1,200 yen an hour, but, you know, we get that, I guess, like, my first little quip about the, like, at first when I saw this, I didn't really pay much attention to it until further themes in the film kind of scurried along, but, like, you know, you get you're instantly taught about the dynamic of the convenience store and their workers, and how they've probably been functioning for the last several years under this type of management.
Yeah, it's look at any kind of low-paying retail store or like store clerk job. Those employees hate it there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, can attest. Retail, that was an experience.
And, like, Ichiko is, like, the only reason that she's there is because that's probably the only thing she's qualified to do. Like, we don't get into a lot of her backstory, like, outside of her like, one kind of working experience that's brought up in that interview, is that she helped out at her family's restaurant a couple of times, and apparently is not very good at it. But I also love that scene because, for whatever reason, the manager just starts, like, staring off into space in the middle of the interview and just ignoring her. And that,
aww,
that lasts for, like, 40 seconds, and it's just so awkward and funny. But, yeah, yes. It's the perfect job for Ichiko, because that's literally all she could do. Like, that would go to, like, from a Western context, we would think, like, oh, that's, like, a 17-year-old's job. Like, that's, like, something that we give to as a first job kind of deal, and it's literally the only thing she's qualified for. So it's just further cementing how much of her life is in shambles.
Which is funny, because she's actually the youngest at that convenience store among the employees that we've seen, and ex-employees that we've seen. Which, by the way, can we talk about her?
The
Yakiudon lady.
Oh, I love her. Like,
I love her too. I think she's probably the most likable character in this film.
The one who commits murder is the most likable character. Okay, well, yes, she keeps getting visited as she works like these graveyard shifts by a what seems to be a homeless woman on a scooter and like a whole like survival gear aesthetic to her, who keeps yammering on about these conspiracy theories and taking the expired food. And it's a weird addition to this film. It's like the most strange kind of character that Ichigo comes across, and yeah, she's an absolute delight, and she's a nice kind of off-center to the complete complete grayness of Ichigo.
She's a rather pivotal point for Ichigo's growth as well, because that lady and Ichigo's decision to basically hand Yaki Udon to her, that's like the one controlled decision that Ichigo is consistently making by this point in the film. You know, like, it was the first, or rather, it's the first consistent control that Ichigo is having, because even though the manager is specifically telling her not to give this lady the yaki udon or anything, any other expired products, it go, like, the progression of how we definitely know this is Ichigo's choice goes from the lady verbally asking Ichigo for the food, then at the very, very end, when the food gets locked in a freaking locker, the lady arrives with a key to the locker that Ichigo gave her, knowing that, like, the lady is going to come later on and, you know, retrieve this yaki udon. She's like, you know, this is the first glimpse that the audience gets of, I guess, Ichigo's moral compass, if that makes sense.
It's the first time she's done something for somebody else. Like, it's the growth of not just her moral compass, but like thinking about someone other than herself. Like, because she lived a selfish existence up until this point, and knowing that someone else is doing like worse than her, like, awakens some kind of like empathy in her, and it's the widening of her character from this completely self-centered mess into a much more controlled person, a much like better off complete individual. And as we were saying, what happens with this character is that it begins like a push and pull between her and the manager about the possession of these expired food products, and it escalates to full on robbery and murder when she
Did she actually murder, though?
She emerges with a bloody blade, so I assume that he was stabbed. The blade was
bloody? Oh man, but I'm sorry, that robbery was probably my tied for my most favorite scene in the film.
It's a good joke scene, because like this is after Ichigo gets fired for punching her boss, which is a great scene. Just sick of his constant abuse of her, so she just takes it into her own and punches him in the nose. Good for her, you did it. The homeless woman shows up with a knife and just first robs the store. First takes like empties the register out of from like a 17-year-old like employee who's just laughing at it all. Like, he's going like, seriously? Oh wow, okay.
Seriously, Machika.
And then turns around to, like, the manager and chases him into the back.
She's, like, this tiny little woman with, like, manic little arms, just, like, flailing them about, just running into the back. I love it so much.
Then she emerges with her, like, spoils, her, like, bag full of money, and gives Ichigo, like, a yen coin and leaves. And Ichigo goes, like, thanks, and waves to her.
Bye, Nada!
She witnesses a murder and she goes like, oh, that's fun, okay, and just walks away from her job.
Oh my gosh, yes. Oh god, bless her so much.
She's come a far like a long way from the ketchup stained mess that she was in her parents' house. I guess now is no better time to get into Banana Man.
Banana Man. We're not talking about the comedy duo Banana Man that hosts Nogizaka 46's variety show. We're talking about Mr. Yuji What's-His-Face, who is quite similar to Ichigo in that he's quite a loser himself. And, you know, he's a boxer at the gym that Ichigo, and he's somebody that Ichigo had been eyeing for quite a bit.
Yeah, like we're told that up to this point that she is a virgin, and we assume that she's never been in a relationship before this, and she just becomes fixated with Yuji Kano, the character, like the amateur boxer, and for whatever reason, she just becomes like infatuated with him, just like staring at him in like the boxing gym doing his whole routine,
Which
and.
I mean, mood.
I suppose so. Like, he seems in pretty good shape, and he seems like
I mean,
he.
Araihiro Fumi is quite a, it's he's nice to look at sometimes, quite a bit. In this role, in this role, not as much as I'd like to, but Araihiro Fumi is quite it is a nice thing to look at.
Yeah, and so their relationship, whatever it is, kind of blossoms after, He frequents the store to buy bananas, which is why everyone at the at, all the employees call him Banana Man because they're very creative with their nicknames, and like he just kind of tells her to go on a date with him, and for and that entire date, he is just silent. He doesn't talk to her. They don't talk to each other, and nothing comes of it. So this whole like.
I love that it's at a zoo as well. It actually is like it looks like he put effort into this date, but
No, I don't think so at all.
no, he definitely like in terms of location, that's a definite like effort on his part to go to a zoo. That's like romantic aquarium shit that you can
Okay, but look at like the discrepancy here. So he just says like, "Hey, meet me here afternoon at the boxing gym. We'll go on a date." And it's implied that he's extremely late for that. And then they go to a zoo. They see a couple of animals, and they don't interact at all on this thing. She's like
Yeah,
constantly,
that
she's constantly looking at him for validation and stuff. He's just silent.
the interaction is definitely where he probably didn't think that part through.
And then we look at it from the other side at Ichigo, who actually tried to make herself pretty for this date, and it's also very like tragicomic in that way because she buys quote unquote sexy underwear from the 100 yen store and puts on deodorant and a dress for the first time, and it's again, very pathos inducing because you're looking at her, it's like, this was your best effort. Oh God. Oh girl.
Yeah, no, because like the underwear itself clearly does not fit. Looks really, really uncomfortable to be stuffed into, and she was genuinely so excited about it. You know, she was genuinely so excited to put on the sexy underwear for him.
That's one. Now this is one of my favorite scenes, but not because of the reason you think. It's like her checking out her ass in the mirror, like because it is so ill-fitting and it looks terrible on her, and like you just feel so bad for her, but she thinks it looks fine because she doesn't know better.
Exactly, you know, she hasn't really developed a sense of
Anything.
ex yeah, well, that too, or expressing herself through I guess ideal clothing.
Yeah, and so they begin this relationship, I guess, but like it amounts to one date, and then he shows up drunk and sick, or like either drunk or sick at the 100 yen store after like no, I'm getting the details confused around it. He tries to pay for his bananas with boxing tickets to his final fight, and at And after that, he like goes. He loses his final fight because in the context of professional boxing in Japan, like there's a cutoff date for amateurs, and you have to get a certain number of fights into like that before you turn like 37.
There's a cutoff age for everything in Japan, let's be real.
Pretty much, yeah. So unless he has like a professional record before he turns like 37, like no one would fight him any longer. Like he can't be recognized by any kind of boxing league or organization or federation or anything. So he loses that fight, and that fight is kind of what spurs Ichigo into taking boxing because a reason we'll get into later. But he becomes this completely despaired individual. Like, his life is over now, essentially. He can't do the thing that he always wanted to do. And
might we add as well that Ichigo is on a supposed date with another coworker?
Yeah, like, this is related to the trigger warning we gave at the beginning of the episode. Noma-san. Let's just break off this whole, like, discussing dissecting the relationship to talk about one of the most frustrating and ugly characters I have seen in a good long while. I hate this guy.
We all hate him. He reminds us of somebody probably that we know, and we all hate him for it. Like, or he reminds us of the worst person we know times 10.
Noma-san is a talkative egotist who he's employed alongside Ichigo to run the graveyard shifts and just talks her goddamn ear off with this inane nonsense before revealing himself to be a complete sexual predator, which is just great.
I do gotta say, before we go into that, I actually think that those shots where Ichigo's doing the mundane convenience store works, such as like putting stuff on the shelf or sitting in the back or doing cash, and he's just yapping away. Like, there's many cutscenes in a row of that, and it's just, I actually love those shots. Those shots in particular really set the tone for the douche kebab that we know he's gonna be.
And even beyond that, I think it's a really good performance, because like the whole point of the character is to hate him, and like by the end of it, like, man, like, he sells just scumbaggery so well.
Oh yes. Basically, without going into details about the scene itself that we talked about in the trigger warning, after he rapes her full on, a scene that I found very, very noteworthy is she immediately called the police right after, and we don't see that a lot in Japanese cinema, and I think it was very important that that scene itself was showed. Of course, we don't know the outcome, and we know for a fact that he wasn't caught right off the bat because he comes back and robs the store.
Yep.
But I think it was very pivotal in terms of something that Japanese society had essentially lacked, and that was the rise for women against something basically despicable that a man has caused them. And, you know, that this is where, like, my confusion about the whole film teeter-totters, because this scene in particular of her calling the police is so essential to not only her growth, but also to the movie's intended message, I'm gonna try and say. But also, it was something nice for me to look at in particular. It was something nice for me as a woman to see this poor girl that, you know, probably everybody at a point could relate to, finally have her moment of power
in a manner, because my reading on the sequence and like her reaction to it is it's folded into the film's just presentation of her life as a series of blows against her, like her almost calm demeanor, and I don't want to say accepting, but like numbing experience to it all, is just because she's used to life dumping on her, and this is just one more punch thrown at her. So she just rolls with it and does the most logical thing and call the police on him. It's interesting manner to handle it, because I think we both agree that, like, unless completely necessary, you don't need to include sexual assault into your screenplay. And, like, this could be represented as any kind of adversity to her. But I think there is a degree of agency being offered to this character in the way it's presented. Like, it's very pragmatic the way that she deals with this extreme trauma of being sexually assaulted. She calls the police and then, like, bemoans how much it hurts to move after
that was painful to watch itself.
And then just spends the rest of the day, like, lying down, and the next day she just goes to work as normal. Like, it's
no,
tough.
but she, but there is also the psychological impact where for a little bit after, or quite a bit after, actually, she hesitates to have men touch her.
I didn't notice that at all.
There was in the boxing ring, whenever like she got smaller, there was like her noticeable flinching as well. Whenever I believe it was the other manager got close to her, there was like we saw this, and this goes back into Ando's performance herself, where she's actually thinking from the position of someone who has had something horrible done to her, and thus
Okay.
her behavior has really altered, like her behavior around men in particular has been greatly altered. She, while she was numb and pragmatic and had basically lacked social skills, this time we were right after that scene, we were now seeing the more physical side of, like, while verbally she was still okay, or okay for Ichigo, physically I definitely saw a vast difference in her posture, in her mannerisms, and in her demeanor overall.
And the assault is kind of one of the many catalysts that pushes her into taking amateur boxing. Like, it's kind of framed in multiple ways. One, as a manner that she can finally defend herself in case a similar situation happens again. But also, and like, this was my reading on like why she becomes a boxer. Because another way to look at it would be that she's trying to get closer to Banana Man. I'll just call him Yuji from now on, just to make it easier and stop saying Banana Man so many times. But it's
I mean,
like
check out the comedy duo, they're great, but
I'll take your word for it. But like, it's a way to, like, that she could be closer to Yuji in a way. But also, and I think this is like the main reason she does it. It's because she's sick of life throwing punches at her and unable to do anything about it. I think that's like the central metaphor working here, like why she becomes a boxer, 'cause like it's like the only kind of sport, activity, hobby that encourages you to be punched and keep going. And like her, what she sees, like when she goes to Yuji's amateur fight, which he loses, is that after the fight, after like these people beat the shit out of each other, it's all fine. Like they pat each other on the back, say good fight, and that's what she really appreciates. Like that at the end of the day, like all the pain that we deal with is brushed aside as being like it's part of the process, and like that, I think that's what she gravitates towards and why she begins this intensive boxing training.
it is a definite surprise that she liked that aspect of boxing itself, you know, the whole community and the atmosphere of it. Like, because the fact of the matter is, we wouldn't expect somebody with that type of social ineptness to be so content and happy with that kind of situation, like that kind of I guess circumstance of being physical and being part of a group and being part of a community dynamic.
Like, I don't even think it's a part of a community dynamic. Like, that's what she's seeing in it, because I still think she's very like very independent, very in her own world. But I think she just like goes towards boxing because it's a world wherein like all the pain that you felt is for something. Like it has a clear kind of logistic backing, because this is a woman, as I've been framing it, has been like being beaten down by life for 32 years of her life, and now here's a finally something somewhere where she can punch back, and that's why she just throws her all into it.
I gotta say, it was very amusing for me when she entered the boxing gym. Number one, I thought this was actually a pretty good gym. I just gotta say, it's related to nothing, but the instructors, I would join this gym. This was a they have a good teaching ethic there. But I gotta say, it was very endearing to see how comedically bad she was starting out, like how awkward and how it's not even somebody who is trying boxing for the first time and, you know, is trying the moves the best they can, and they suck. No, it's Ichigo literally having chicken arms and putting her little fists maybe above her forehead by this point, and just like literally being so massively, horribly bad at boxing, so comedically bad that you're just like, oh, bless her. Bless this little child.
we have to be shown how...
Like, but she sucks.
Yeah, like, she's starting off on such a bad foot, because we all have to start somewhere. Like, she's never been in a fight in her life outside of with her sister in the opening couple of scenes. But, like, the whole point is to show, like, she's going to... There's going to be a transformation here. She's going to be from this schlubby 32-year-old who has pretty much only eaten junk food for the past 3 decades of her life to someone who is physically fit, can take as many punches as you can throw at her and throw them back just as hard. And there are so many scenes of both her training and both of her, like, running and doing, like, the...
Those Rocky scenes, I gotta say.
Those boxing stances where she, like, shifts her weight back and forth and, like, throws a, like, shadow boxing while she's on a run. It's like, yeah, I'm so into this. Like, we all love a good sports montage. It's unavoidable. And, like, yeah. It's funny because you bring up the Rocky thing because, like, you know, that's the gold standard of all kind of boxing films like this. Because at the end of the day, this is a boxing film. It's a sports drama wherein, like, one strain of their life to become good at a sport dovetails into the other strain of their life of keeping their life together.
But I gotta say, what's funny about this little Rocky montage and how this is when she starts to get good.
Several
Rocky montages. But it's funny to see the total 360 she goes in her abilities once Yuji dumps her. There's a scene where Yuji finally gets a job after freeloading at her place for quite a bit, and he has a rather, well, moderately more attractive than Ichigo of a coworker, and the coworker notes how cool he is, and thus, he instantly dumps Ichigo and refuses to go back to her home where he was freeloading, and then calls her his sister. And then immediately after that, somehow, some miraculous nudge from God, her precision got so much better, her, like, her punches just became more powerful, her stamina got so much better, she was just kicking it, and I'm just, like, here sitting with my curry being like, damn, girl, just, I wanna work out too, but... I really wish a man didn't cause the catalyst for that improvement.
So you really think that the reason why she started to throw herself into boxing was to get Yuji back?
Not to get him back, but rather to get revenge on him.
No, see, like, I read that completely differently because when the breakup happens, like, she's more confused and saddened by it. Like, she doesn't understand why he would do something like that. Like, she's just frustrated. And I think that frustration just fuels into the boxing because rather than doing it for him, like, as I said, like, that could be a way to look at it, that the boxing was a way to bring them together closer. And it was also, like, part of the reason why he left. It's very confusing why he left, but he says, like, I didn't like seeing you throw your all into something. And
he says this when she invites him to her first match. So he says, I don't like watching people give their everything into something. So it shows how much of a, like, how insecure he is with his own work ethic.
Yeah, and, like, moving off of that, like, I think the reason why, like, she doubled down on her training and took so much care into it is because she's finally just doing it for herself. Like, she's broken off from Yuji and it's no longer part of her training process, like, thinking about him. Now it's solely for herself and to prove that possibly that she's better than him, but also possibly that she can do something by herself. Like, this is like the first thing that she's ever, like, done significantly with her life.
I think it was the, at a point, yes, like, once, she's at, like, she was asking to start competing, and once she, kind of, I think by this point she had gotten fired from her Hyakuen shop's job and started working with the family. And you see the vast improvement she has made socially with her talking ability and mm-hmm. her even the way she moves. Like, the way she moves is no longer awkward and hunched over and
'cause she's in better shape.
Yeah, she's in much better shape, but she's also much more confident and her shoulders are out. And I think I focus on the body quite a bit just because of the amount of voice and body work I've done. But, you know, her shoulders, her posture, everything is just vastly improved. And it comes in handy when people appear at your family's store causing you to run the hell out of there and chase him down so that you could invite him to your first match.
She doesn't chase him down to invite him to the match. She chases him down to ask why he left, because he left without a single, like, a reason given. I also love that sequence because it shows just, like, where both of their lives are at, because, you know, he used to be an amateur boxer. He was very much in shape. And she catches him so fast. He's, like, out of breath after he leaves, like, runs away from the stand after, like, one block. And she, like, just overtakes him and starts, like, badgering him with questions. It's yeah. Because, like, man, you completely underestimated this woman.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Fuck Yuji.
Like, the reason why I think Yuji is, like, so fascinating as, like, a character is because he's one of those types who can't ever see life going good for him. Like, at this point, like, he has a, like, live-in girlfriend, they both have jobs, like, there's a degree of normalcy to their life, and he decides, no, I don't want that. For whatever reason, I can't commit to that. So he just, on a whim, goes off with another woman. Like, I don't think it's because, like, as you say, she's prettier than Sakura Ando. Like, and how dare you? Sakura Ando's one of the most beautiful women in the world. I can't believe you're throwing shade at her like that.
I ain't! The writer! Excuse me!
Don't apologize to me. Apologize to her next time you see her.
Okay, fine. I will see her next week.
Good. Now, and I don't think it's because, like, she's a more beautiful woman, like, to him. I think it's just because, like, it's something he can do to ruin his life, and as a self-destructive person, he's just gonna keep doing it. Like, it didn't have to be her, it could have been anything. If someone offered him, like, a job in an oil rig, he would have just taken it, because it's a way to get him out of that normalcy. And it's showing just how toxic of a relationship they would have had if it stuck out. So, yeah, I think it's a completely justified reason for him to be written as he is.
Yeah, I definitely... Well, to be written as he is, definitely for the sake of the film, that's inarguable. But I do think that Yuji is the type of person who has... While he is definitely more on the loser's side, he has shown a little bit of pride. That, you know, he has very little of it, but when anything shakes it up, even the slightest... whether it's good or bad, whether it's a good or bad hit for it, he lashes out in quite, I want to say explosive, ways with the pride itself. I actually have a little bit of, like, some examples here. Well, number one, he invites Ichigo to the boxing match full of confidence that, he can win her with that alone.
Are you sure about that?
I mean, like, he invited her there, like, no way after a date, right? Well,
he didn't invite her there. He gave her tickets to pay for bananas.
I would say that, but deliberately, though, because he didn't even take the bananas. He never takes his bananas. He just goes there for the purpose of, he's noticed Ichigo from the start. He, when he forgot his bananas and paid Ichigo... Ichigo ran over to the boxing gym and gave the bananas to him, and he was like, so you work there? I've seen you here before. Like, I've seen you staring into the gym before. I've seen you being a little creep and staring in. So we know from the get-go that he's known Ichigo for, like, he knows Ichigo by face, at the very least, for a bit. And the fact of the matter that, like, he pays money and then puts it in, like, either puts it in the tip box or whatever and doesn't take the bananas... Like, if he's paying for bananas with the tickets, why not take the goddamn bananas?
I think just because he's a hard character to read. Like, he's just deliberately frustrating. So, like, I don't think we can ever be sure about anything that he does. I think we both have our different readings on him.
Yeah, I mean, well, the fact, but also the fact that he punches Sada, which is a very, very satisfying scene. He punches Sada when Sada basically goes into nice guy mode and talks about how, you know, he saw that was talking something along the lines of Ichigo begging him to sleep with him, and he's not her type, but he went along anyway to make her happy. And then, you know, like, after he finds out that the woman he was trying to basically fuck was gonna be fucking someone else, he got incredibly, his pride got hurt, so he lashed out in a very severe way and punches Sada in a very public restaurant. Like, I do think he has, like, tendencies where if something is going to be boosting his reputation or boosting, I don't think he cares so much about his reputation, but towards
not at all, he does not care about his reputation
towards towards the end of the film. I think he does have a bit of pride in where he was going in the beginning. There's, like, some glimmer of hope somewhere there, but I do think, like, when a better he has quite a bit of an addictive personality, I would say, where if something better comes along, he takes it.
I suppose so. He's a very, like, I think we're both saying that, like, he's an incredibly flawed and strange character whose motivations we aren't 100% certain of, and mm-hmm. that's why he's an interesting offset to Ichigo, who has a very clearly defined arc to her, and he's just kind of orbiting it, like, and he's really frustrating her development as a character. And I think we should just get into the final scene, like the final boxing scene.
Oh, that's so, it's beautifully shot.
Yeah, it begins with a 3-minute walk-in scene, like a long take of her putting on her gloves, warming up, and getting into the ring, which is, like, I didn't notice.
Every boxing movie in the world.
Yeah, it's not normally done in all in one take, although, like, the Ryan Coogler film Creed, they did it one better by actually having the boxing match also in one take, which, good for them, that's amazing. I love this whole sequence and, like, the story that it tells. Because throughout, like, the 3 rounds that we're presented with, she gets her ass handed to her. Like, her face just, like, punches just rain down upon her, and she just takes this punishment over and over again. And the whole narrative of the match just becomes, like, at least throw one punch. Like, your punishment throughout the entire film, but specifically in this ring, like, it's not worth it unless you throw a punch back. And that becomes the whole, like, story of the fight. It's like, when will she fight back?
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit into the beginning, where right before the scene, Ando cuts her hair, and as we've all learned from the very, very entertaining roommates of Terrace House, normally when a woman cuts her hair, she indicates some kind of a very, even in America we do this, but I say America as if I live there, but when a woman cuts her hair, that indicates a whole new life change, either a breakup or a step towards something bigger for them. And she essentially glows up, and we for the first time are seeing form-fitting clothes on this really tiny body that we're now realizing. And we're seeing a girl with much smoother skin and much more of a complexion, and she finally looks like she has life breathed in her, if that sounded correct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's a whole thing where like the symbolic means of cutting your hair, like, it shows, like, a transition in your life, something has transformed, like, there's something different about you. But also it has a pragmatic reason, because, like, long hair is not great for boxers, like, so mm-hmm. it would make sense for her to cut her hair, and, like, she rocks also, that look. So
yeah, but also her hair's finally all the same color rather than her inches of roots pouring down from her face. Her hair is all the same color now, which is great too.
Yeah, she's on a level. She is now leveled out, and everything is, like, hopefully going well for her. But they don't go well for her in this fight. Like,
I do.
She loses.
Physically, yes, she does lose However, what I appreciated in the fight was how much support she was getting outside of the ring. She was getting tons of love from her sister, who was like screaming at her to punch back. She was getting stares of awe from her parents, who really didn't believe in her, but like have now wanted, like, now understand her love for the sport. And she and Yuji was for some reason there, even though he was a dickwad and said in the beginning that he wasn't sure if he was gonna, like, no, not that he wasn't sure, he said straight up no, he didn't want to come because he didn't want to see people giving it their all, but he still came anyway because what do you know. Reminds me of somebody I know, by the way. But yeah, she's getting all this love and support, and despite having her the literal shit kicked out of her, are we allowed to swear? I just swore, it doesn't matter. She, like, tied with the robbery. My absolute favorite scene was at the very end where she walks up to her opponent, who, by the way, we've established is a seasoned boxer and has a, it has a very impressive resume.
Relatively. She's also an amateur, but she has, like, 5 wins.
Yeah, something like that. And she goes up to her opponent, hugs her and thanks her, like, despite having a bloody mouth and a bloody nose and whatchama and dying, basically, she still has, like, the enough energy to walk up and hug her really tight, and that was just so heartfelt for me to watch. I really enjoyed that gratitude she has just to be in the ring.
Not only to be in the ring, but to have that punishment mean something for once. To show on a public stage that no matter what, she will keep moving. She will keep going. She will keep getting up at the end and thanking whoever it was who beat them down. And it's a really kind of pained scene because as we all know, the way that these sports films, like these like cliched sports films, usually run is their life hits rock bottom, they train, they get better, and they win, essentially. Like, they become the champion, or what have you. And this is, like, that rare kind of sports film, which I love, and this is, like, one of my favorite kind of aspects of this, like, sports film genre, is when it doesn't turn out like you think it will. Where they put all this effort in, they become a good, like a decent to good boxer, and they still lose. Because sometimes life doesn't work out that way. But the whole point is that the experience did mean something. All that effort, it amounted to something in the end. It wasn't for naught. And it's kind of a hard lesson to learn sometimes because we want her to win. We want her to do well. But it's so much more, like, gratifying to know that all of that punishment inflicted on her face, like, wasn't for nothing.
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know about other people who've watched it, but I, as a viewer, kind of knew she wasn't going to win. I knew, like, she was going to have one last life punch, pun intended.
Okay.
Go ahead. If we can go into the very, very, very final scene of the film where she... Yuji is waiting for her. She goes up to him. She cries about how she wanted to win, and then they walk off together.
It's ambiguous, I'll say that much, but it's one of the most, like, heartbreaking scenes because, like, yes, like, up until that point she's all, like, she has it together. She's like putting up a facade of, like, this was worth something, I'm very happy, but, like, the mask kind of slips and, like, her true feelings come out, where it's like, I just wanted to win something. Like, life owes me one victory, and that's really hard to watch, especially because it's the most emotion that Ichigo's shown up to this point, and it's so honest and vulnerable.
And we all wanted it. We all feel for her, and we all just wanted her to have at least one victory. However, like, to me, the way I translated this moment was her victory was in Yuji, which I did not like, it did not sit well with me.
Oh, I didn't read that at all.
Yeah, like, I mean, they walk off holding hands, dude.
So?
Like, I mean, that's something in Japanese, like, that's something in Japanese society. You don't just hold hands.
That's with... something in every society, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get back together, move in, and, like, have children. Like, it's not,
I
like...
I mean, obviously not, but, like, I think the fact that this was the very, very final shot we see the douche kebab and the girl we've been rooting for just holding hands, it leaves like a bad aftertaste for me.
Well, do remember that they did have a semblance of a good relationship up to a point. They were loving and caring of each other. It's just they're both self-destructive people, so it didn't work out because they can't have that much normalcy in their lives. I think this ending can, like, very divide, has the capacity to divide people, as it has done on this podcast. Like, I'm much more cynical of this ending, because I don't think it's a feel-good ending. I think it's, if anything, it's going to, like, begin another cycle of her having to drag Yuji into a level of respectability for her newfound confidence and control. And I think it's just gonna open up a whole nightmare of a relationship for them. And, you know, that happens.
Yeah, I got the... just because it was the final shot we were getting of somebody we've been following for, what was it, 2 hours? It was the final shot of somebody we've been rooting for 2 hours. And then... I feel like a mother where I'm just like, he's just not good for you, honey. It's like, just the fact that, like, those visual cue of her walking off and having that weird ass, I'm sorry, can we talk about the weird ass music choice? I love it, but at the same time, I'm like, wait, what? Where did they find this, like, music,
That song's an absolute banger. Like, I love
it. Yeah, what is this song? I was like, I literally wrote that in my note. I'm like, what is this song? What is this? This was, I gotta say, the song itself was a nice overlay, a good distraction, for my eyes, at least.
it's the same song that, like, because that's the intro to, like, the, like, faster punk number that, like, plays over all the montage sequences. So it's like it's a nice callback to that, and I think it fits the ending quite well. Just a weird little note to go out on for a weird little ending.
Speaking of endings, is this the first time we've managed to be chronological in a podcast?
Not for a long time, because for the longest time we've been. For the films that we've been doing, it's just like we have things we want to talk about, and so, like, we'll get to that, we'll jump around, we'll do whatever. In this case, like, this isn't a chronological podcast, it's just this is a very linear story. It's telling the ascension to just being a normal, quote-unquote normal person, like a respectable member of society, of Ichigo. So it takes that time. We had to go at, like, point by point to see, like, how she fixes her mess of a life and then gets punched a lot.
Wow. So with that note, do we have anything more to add?
No, I think that will cover it. I like the movie. You're a little bit more cold on it, just because of certain aspects of the plot, which is fair. This has become, like, a real favorite of mine, and it just allows Ando to shine so nicely in it. Like, she took home a lot of acting awards, both in her native Japan and abroad, and yeah, like, I really do like this film.
Yeah, if anything, do watch it for both, actually, the cinematography and for Ando's acting. It's definitely a treat to watch somebody so beautiful be dressed down and have so many attempts at making her look something she's not, which she succeeds quite a bit of degree, but it's just a treat to watch, especially for fans of Ando Sakura.
Yeah, it's like the equivalent of a fat suit. Like, Like, that's what they're trying to go for with this type of role, where it's like, well, how do we make this person, like, unattractive to an audience? Like, I don't know, just throw some grease on her face, like, tell her not to wash for a couple days.
Make her look like a fuzzy Sadako.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so, with that, we've come to the end of the podcast itself. Chris, do you want to drop your socials?
Yeah, sure, why not? You can follow me on Twitter at cinemacreep@twitter.com. And also you can follow the podcast itself at Egg and Night Podcast on twitter.com. Aruba?
And, oh my gosh, guys, I actually have a Twitter that people can follow if they want to. So it is at Aruba Sultana, which is going to be on the Egg and Night page. And yeah, for once, I could actually tweet in public and not feel ashamed about it.
I mean, we all feel ashamed about what we tweet in public, because Twitter's just a flawed thing that we all do because our brains are broken. But
yeah,
moving forward, for the next podcast we will be doing, we will be saying fuck you to the Academy Awards and their snubbing of Joe Shishida.
Yeah, because why? Why would you do that to that chipmunk angel? Just... No, why?
If you haven't been following the news, Joe Shishida has unfortunately passed. I forget the exact date of it, but he lived a long life, and he is one of Japanese cinema's most accomplished and wonderful actors. And we will be honoring his memory with our next episode on Branded to Kill, Seijin Suzuki's incredible film. There's so much I want to say about it. I've seen this film like 7 times. It is one of my favorites.
Yeah, this will be a second time watch for me. We both had the pleasure of watching it in class before.
Yeah, and I cannot wait to really try as much as we can to break open this film, because it's a hard one to figure out.
Do we got the time, though? Do we even have the time? Like, I'm supposed to be logging off the computer in 12 minutes, Chris. Like, do you really think we're going to be able to do this podcast in an hour or so?
Oh, yeah, for that one, like, we'll try. Like, we'll dial it back a bit, as much as we just want to gush constantly about that masterpiece.
Yes. And we're really, really excited and happy. And all right. Yeah, look at us. Look at us doing 2 podcasts in a month.
Maybe 3. We don't know.
Maybe, yeah, we don't know. All right. So thank you so much for watching. I feel like I'm on YouTube. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And with that, I am Aruba.
And I am Chris. And have a good one.